Why do we drink what we do? Why do some drinks become classics while others languish at the back of the drinks cabinet?
Is it just because we prefer those drinks, or are there underlying economic, social, or technological trends that shape our choices?
And that's what we're going to explore on A Question of Drinks.
Join us as we explore the hidden side of the drinks cabinet, the decisions, reversals, and underlying forces that shape the beverage market. I'm Luli Halstead.
And I'm Felicity Carter. And together we host A Question of Drinks.
Hello, Felicity. Great to catch up with you. So, this is our first episode of our new podcast, A Question of Drinks, which is both exciting, but I also say a little bit intimidating.
You are in safe hands, Luli. I have done this before. In fact, as you will no doubt remember, we recorded an episode together for my other podcast, Drinks Insider, where you were my guest and I was interviewing you about all things data. And that's where we had such a good time recording together that we decided to launch our own podcast.
We did. And is it okay to say, Felicity, that I actually haven't listened back to that episode of Drinks Insider? I don't really like the sound of my own voice when it's recorded.
Well, that's going to be a bit of a problem for doing this podcast. Also, that was a very popular episode. It got downloaded at top speed. But all right, so why did you agree to do this then?
Okay, well, I suppose I'm getting over my own problem of listening to my own voice. I'm just really fundamentally interested in researching all things drinks. So why we drink what we do, what influences us, how we make our choices. And I guess that's kind of trumped my dislike of hearing myself. And also, I get to spend time chatting with you. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah, well, that's a good thing. Otherwise, this would be a very short episode and a very short series.
Yeah, it would, wouldn't it? So this is how it's going to work then. We are going to explore one big question about drinks in each episode. So in our nerdy ways, we're going to delve into the history, the economics, the culture, the production, pretty much everything. So basically, it's an excuse for us to really get our research hats on. So we have a different question each episode. And today's question comes from my friend Kate, who lives in Surrey here in the UK. And she came up with this question recently, or it came up in a conversation I was having.
Yeah,
with
okay. I'm just going to stop you right there. Is Kate a real person, or is this some sort of cipher you've made up because it's convenient to get this podcast launched?
Come on, Felicity. Surely. We've known each other for many years, and you know that I am a researcher with full researcher ethics and a proud member of the Market Research Society. So I would never claim things that aren't true or make up data, even if it was just a question from my friend Kate.
Sure. Okay, so what did this lady, this completely true lady, Kate, who lives in Surrey, have to ask?
Okay, so I have known Kate since we were 15, so I do have full proof of her existence. I would say, in fact, probably over the years, Kate and I have shared rather a lot of, let's say, drinking moments together. But maybe those details are best not shared here for her sake and mine. Mm-hmm. So. So let me bring myself back on track. So Kate, the real person, and her question. So she said, I've noticed that I'm drinking different styles of wine now compared with 30 years ago when I first started drinking wine. Is it just me, or have some wine styles suddenly become unpopular? So she went on to say, I used to drink bigger, bolder style of red wine most of the time, but I now find myself increasingly enjoying lighter styles of red, more white wine, and she said, especially more rosé. She also said, I also started out mainly drinking French wine because that's what my parents had. It was their go-to. But I now find myself drinking more wines that come from Chile, Australia, New Zealand, and even England. So if wine styles have changed, why is that, she says? Is it just fashion, or have some styles of wine that are being made fundamentally changed?
All right. So nobody can accuse you of a lack of ambition in this podcast. This is probably one of the biggest questions in wine or drinks generally that we could kick off with. First of all, the answer is yes, we are drinking very different wines.
Yeah. Okay. So let me put the question to you, Felicity, before we delve in. Have the styles of wine that you drink changed over the last 30 years? And by the way, full disclosure, that does age us both.
It does, yes. Yes, thank you for that. Yes, when I first started drinking wine, which was in the late 90s, and I should say I came to wine quite late, I was drinking in Australia. And so we were all drinking those very tannic, very high alcohol fruit bombs, which I don't drink anymore at all. And in fact, a lot of people don't either. Like most people who've changed their taste, I'm drinking more white wine and sparkling. What about you?
Yeah, we're not dissimilar, actually. So if I think back to how the styles of wine have changed that I'm drinking, I'm mainly a white wine drinker. And I certainly sort of grew up through wine, primarily drinking Sauvignon Blanc. That's now changed to Chardonnay and particularly moving to more kind of oak style. So I think maybe my palate has changed. I'm also drinking more sparkling wine. It's featuring in more occasions. I don't know whether that's the same for you.
Yes, very much so.
Also, like Kate, I'm drinking more rosé. My favourite rosé drinking moment was, I think it was about 6 or 7 years ago, and I was speaking at the Vinpro Wine Conference in Cape Town in South Africa. And we did this amazing hike to Hermanus along the coast. And when we got there, there was this fantastic kind of really casual beach bar serving rosé that they automatically bought a bucket of ice alongside so you could fill your glass of rosé up with ice, which I just thought was fantastic. I'm also drinking more other stuff than wine, so more cocktails, which I think is a kind of lockdown legacy, and whiskey as well. So, yeah, so it's changed for me.
Yeah. Okay, so before we get into this discussion, and I'm sure you've got some of your amazing research handy, perhaps it would be a good idea to define what a wine style actually is. Now, you're the research and data maven. Have you got any definitions about this?
Okay, so Felicity, you know me too well. I'm always going to have some handy data and research. So there was a paper published in, and this really puts me in nerdy territory, one of my favourite academic journals, which is the Journal of Wine Research.
And it really is. Favourite academic journals. And you read it in bed, Lily?
Yeah. Again, for another podcast. So the Journal of Wine Research, which is a fab journal, by the way. And this paper was published in 2024. And the title of the paper was A Question of Style, an Analysis of the Use of the Concept of Style in the Wine Industry. So it's kind of like they knew we were going to do this podcast.
That was very kind of them.
Indeed it was. It was very handy. So this paper was written by a couple of researchers, academics at the University of Florence, and they used different types of data input to explore this question around what wine style is. So they did interviews with wine professionals and they also used netnography.
Okay. What is netnography?
Okay. So netnography is the word portmanteau when you bring two words together. Yeah, that's okay, right. I've got that right. Yes. Oh, well done. Well done me, I remembered. So it's the combination of two words, so internet and ethnography. So it's a qualitative research method, and it's the study of communities and culture online. So the ethnography bit is the research stemming from anthropology, and that's all about when we're using research to understand culture and behaviour and people in their natural environments.
Gosh, that's really interesting. That is a portmanteau word, and I think the person who came up with the idea of the portmanteau word was Lewis Carroll.
Okay, you talk about me being random with data and facts.
Let me not derail the conversation. So what did they discover?
Okay, so their main finding was, not surprisingly, that there is not a clear, consistent or even systematic way of categorising or defining wine style, which I guess is not so helpful for our podcast, given that we're talking about wine style.
Yeah, I can imagine that there would be, you know, multiple ways you could classify, categorize wine style. But what did they say in the end?
Well, they found that how wine style is classified actually does vary by wine market. So let's take the US as an example, you know, partly because it's the largest market in the world by volume of wine consumed. And in the US, they found that typically wine styles are defined more by market trends and consumer preference. So hence, we get this really broad range of wine styles coming out of the US or exported to the US to meet these varying kind of consumer demands. And then if we contrast that, they found in France, so here we're talking about French consumers consuming wine in France rather than exporting. So in France, styles of wine are much more defined by traditional cues and primarily around what we know as terroir. So where terroir being the unique characteristic of a wine style based on its vineyard location.
Okay, so I could imagine that wine style is, in a commercial setting, is defined, say, by retailers who have to work out what they're going to put where on the shelf. And so they create categories. And if I understand you correctly, what you're saying is in the old world, it's more determined by its agricultural appellation origins.
Yeah, kind of broadly, yes, based on this research anyway. And that's, as we know, because of the regulations that and systems that are in the old world countries, you know, France, Italy, Spain, where being produced within these geographically delineated areas, you get much more restriction in terms of, for example, what grape varieties you're permitted to grow and to a certain extent, the vinification processes that are enabled by the appellations or the equivalent system.
And this is why people complain that wine is extremely complicated.
Indeed.
So, okay, so if I was thinking about wine styles off the top of my head, I would think first and foremost about colour. I'd think about whether it was red or white or rosé or sparkling. Then I'd probably think about what price level it belonged to, maybe where the country it is that it comes from, a specific region, and, of course, grape variety. So I might think about a Cabernet Sauvignon in some circumstances, and in other circumstances I might think about I'll buy a Bordeaux wine.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's right. And if you look at the consumer data there, depends again which market you're in. But typically in most markets, the kind of starting point of the hierarchy for consumers after price is typically would be grape variety. Right. In some other markets, you know, in the more old world countries, it might be more about region or location.
Okay, so am I missing anything else?
Well, I'd probably add in now, I'd put in alcohol level, actually, because I think, yeah, we could consider this as a style, particularly low and no, as that is a small but growing proportion of the wine market and becoming, again, if you look at the data from IWSR, the alcohol level has over the last 15 years become increasingly important in consumers' choice as a choice cue. And then I would probably add also kind of natural or low intervention, sometimes called orange wine, maybe even sustainable and biodynamic. So as a category or a wine style in and of itself.
Yeah, it's interesting. Okay, so what we've got is that wine style is such a broad thing that it's almost useless for anybody's purposes apart from retailers. So let's talk about, I think most people would think in terms of at the base, something like red, white, sparkling, rosé, and regions. And we do know that these fall in and out of popularity. So maybe it's time to talk about how the changes, what sort of changes happen that drives whether something is popular or not. So I think in general, if you look back, technology will drive trends. A classic one would be rosé, which we've all been drinking more of in the last 20 years. So if you look at the rise of social media and Instagram, you get the rise of a colour called millennial pink. So it made rosé very popular for Instagrammers because they liked holding a glass of it against a blue swimming pool. And this was one of the things that helped to spread. It wasn't the only thing, but it was a major thing. So this is a clear instance of technology driving the style.
Yeah. And I think rosé is a really good example, actually, of how wine styles or which different types of wine styles can become popular. And if you remember, Kate, the real person, my friend, mentioned rosé in her question too. But I'd just like to kind of remind us that, yes, rosé has grown as a proportion of wine consumed globally. But if we look at the data from the OIV, they say that it's about 9.5, so just under 10% of still wine consumed globally now is rosé. So that's still relatively small compared to red and white. Now, is up from 20 years ago. And again, according to the OIV, that was just over 8% kind of 20 years ago. So it has risen proportionally, but red has declined proportionally within that same time horizon. Again, looking at the OIV data.
Okay, can you just explain what the OIV is?
Well, if I had the ability, Felicity, not to butcher French pronunciation, I could tell you in French. Yeah. So I'll tell you how they term themselves in English. It's the International Organization of the Vine and Wine. So butchering French or indeed any languages is something that I have a tendency to do. And it reminds me of when I don't know whether you had this in your schooling, because I know you were brought up or went to school in lots of different places, but we had this language laboratory at school in our French classes where you'd have a microphone and headphones at each desk. So the teacher would ask us questions in French and then we would reply clearly, supposedly in French. And I spent way more time swapping my microphone and headphones with my neighbour so that the teacher got completely freaked out when my mouth wasn't moving and yet there were answers coming out of my microphone. So maybe I should have paid more attention than I'd actually be able to tell you what the OIV was.
We didn't have that system in Australia when I was learning languages. We had a system where the teacher would stand at the front and groan and then throw pieces of chalk at us before it was illegal to do that.
I think that ages us, Felicity.
Yeah, I think it does. I think the method that your teachers were using was probably better. Bringing it back, the OIV is a global body that harmonises trade regulations. And as part of their remit, they also keep an eye on how many vineyards there are in the world and how much wine people are consuming.
Mm. Yeah. So back to wine styles. What other case studies do you have about wine styles that have either fallen into or out of favour?
Well, maybe because I'm sitting here in Germany, I have a really great case study.
Oh, go. I love your case studies. Go on.
Okay, so for all of the time I've been a wine writer, which is more than 20 years now, I've heard about the idea of a Riesling Renaissance, that wine writers really love Riesling, love everything about the grape. It's called a noble grape, and they can't wait for it to come back in style, which it was very briefly in the 1970s. But for some reason, it just never comes back, and people can't understand why. Now, one of the reasons is because it always, and one of the things they always bring up is they always say, you know, back in the day, back in the 19th century, a bottle of Riesling was more expensive than some of the top Bordeaux. You know, it was a really valued wine. So what happened? Well, it's called a wine law, and they also said that you could produce Riesling, but you could mix it with other grapes without declaring it on the label. So this was the 1971 wine law, which basically changed production standards. Now, what this did was it meant that very poor quality producers were able to label in the same way that very high quality producers were. And in order to sort of make sales, some of the poorer quality producers made wine that was very sweet and had a lot of other things in it. And so what happened inside Germany is that the reputation of Riesling just collapsed. They destroyed it almost overnight. So they had this huge volume.
I didn't know that. So you're saying that they could blend Riesling with other grapes?
That's right. And so so they had this huge volume of wine that nobody inside Germany was drinking, and so they had to do something with it. So they began to create export brands like Blue Nun, and they flooded the world with this very cheap, sweet wine. Now, in the early 1970s, it wasn't a bad moment to be doing that, because a lot of people were embracing wine for the first time, and sweetness is always a good way into the category. But as people became more sophisticated, not only did they abandon these wines, but they never touched them again. It completely destroyed the reputation of Riesling for about two generations. And it's only now, after inside Germany, people have done a huge amount of work, but it's that it's coming back. But here's the problem, and it's a really big problem. It's a commercial problem, is that once something falls out of the market, the infrastructure that supported it also goes away. So you lose the shelf space that was dedicated to Riesling. You lose the importers who specialized in Riesling. They've switched over to something else or they've retired. And so when you try and bring it back into the market, it's though you're bringing a whole new product and a whole new category that you have to create from scratch. So that's one of the forces that lies behind not just wine, but any consumer good. And that's the question of, is there an infrastructure to support it?
Yeah, that's really fascinating. And particularly what you're saying there about infrastructure and that being a key factor that's influencing wine style that we have now. So do you think Riesling will come back?
It doesn't when people champion it. Like there's some smellies in New York that champion, but I spoke to a friend of mine, Richard Groscher, who's CEO of a wine group in the Mosel. And he said one of the problems with Riesling is it's a grape that really shows its place. And what that means is you never really know what you're going to get unless you're a wine expert and you understand what each region produces in terms of style. So if you order a Riesling and you've grown up drinking Rieslings from the Mosel and you get one from the Clare Valley in Australia, for example, they're going to taste wildly different. And that complexity makes it just very difficult to order wines because you never know what you're going to get. And for a sort of big commercial proposition, that's a non-starter. People have to understand what they're going to get.
Yeah, and it's interesting as you're talking about Riesling there, and it makes me think of the growth of the wine style, Sauvignon Blanc, and particularly from New Zealand.
That's right, yeah.
And to your point about Riesling being a kind of a real expression of where it comes from, so that they, you know, effectively can taste really, really different from each other. You know, that's almost kind of the diametric opposite of what comes out of New Zealand and Marlborough, certainly in terms of the kind of consistency of the Sauvignon Blanc style. And when we look at the data and when we talk to consumers, that's actually the key to the success, is that kind of narrow style band or uniformity of style. Because as a consumer, to your point, you know what you're getting. There's that kind of safe reliability reassurance that it is going to taste within a certain style profile. And that's what's really supported the growth of Sauvignon Blanc, particularly from New Zealand.
This is a podcast dedicated to exploring the world of drinks, uncovering the drivers of the market. It's an interesting topic, but we've got a driver of our own.
That's right, Felicity. We're using this podcast to share our knowledge and experience.
So let me introduce you to the amazing Luli Halsted. She's spent more than 30 years working with wine and spirits businesses around the world. Anybody who knows her knows she's not just a globally respected researcher, but she's a complete data nerd who specializes in understanding drinks trends, consumers, and how to build drinks brands that are profitable. She spent her career focusing on understanding the motivations behind why we drink what we do and what drives our choices. I met her back in 2008 when she was wowing an audience in Sweden with her insights, and she's awesome.
Wow, that's very kind and kind of quite humbling, Felicity, so thank you. Let me introduce you. So Felicity Carter, as I'm sure many of our listeners will know, is internationally renowned and award-winning journalist, editor, and researcher. And she's worked in Europe, the US, UK, Australia. She is one of the most respected authorities on the international wine business. She goes into businesses and sorts out their communication strategies, whether they want a better way to speak to customers or they want to develop a content strategy. And most people don't know about her is that she's also a ghostwriter of books.
So we became friends through our shared passion for understanding the underlying trends and future opportunities in drinks.
Yes, indeed we did, Felicity. And that's why we started this podcast, A Question of Drinks. And you can get in touch if you'd like us to help your drinks business navigate future opportunities and, most importantly, set out a strategy to grow profitably.
And we come as separate individuals.
We do indeed. You can find us both on LinkedIn, Felicity Carter or Luli Halsted, or please connect and drop either of us a DM.
Or get in touch via aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com. That's aquestionofdrinks, all one word, @gmail.com.
But I've got another case study. Can I go with another one? Yeah. So this comes from the Emeritus Professor of Philosophy at San Diego Mesa College, Dwight Farrow. He actually writes some really great stuff. So he's a professor of philosophy, but he's kind of really into wine as well. So he writes quite a lot around the sociology and the psychology of wine. And in an article he wrote in 2018, which was titled "Why Wine Styles Change: A High Alcohol Revolution." So he was looking at what drove the increase in alcohol levels, particularly in Napa Cabernet Sauvignon and Chardonnay, kind of really beginning in the mid 80s. So if we roll the clock back to the 70s, 1970s, typically, not always, but typically, these wines from Napa were sort of more similar to the French style of both Cabernet Sauvignon and Chardonnay. So that means from an alcohol point of view, they were sort of 12, 13 degrees ABV. So that's alcohol by volume. And then we had the famous Judgment of Paris, which you'll remember.
Yes, just to clarify, the Judgment of Paris was in 1976. So it was more something that my parents would remember. But yeah. Thank you. Yes.
Yeah. Sorry. Wasn't meaning to age you again. I meant you're not remember. You're more familiar with.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. So, thank you. We should define what the Judgment of Paris tasting was. It was a famous tasting put on by Stephen Spurrier, a British wine writer and wine merchant in Paris, where he put some California wines up against some top French wines, and the California wines won, which caused shockwaves and still continues to. I mean, most people in the wine industry is still very familiar with this now infamous Judgment of Paris.
Yeah, absolutely. So let's go back to Dwight and his analysis on why there was this kind of real change in wine style coming out of Napa, and particularly around alcohol levels. So he says that there are a number of key reasons. One was consumer demand. So if we think back to the 1980s in the US, it was really a sort of emerging growth market for broad consumption of wine. Up to that point, it had been, you know, much more amongst a smaller proportion of the adult population. So that means, obviously, that for many people, they're drink relatively new to wine, so typically more novice consumers. And because they hadn't really drunk much wine before, and to your point you were making earlier about kind of sweeter wines being more entry, kind of gateway into the category, these were typically sweeter, fuller, smoother styles made from riper grapes, ergo the higher alcohol levels. The second point he makes is the impact of Robert Parker.
Yes, I'll just jump in and explain who Robert Parker was, or who he still is. He's still alive.
Yes.
An extremely famous and important wine critic who came to prominence in the early 1980s. He liked the big, robust sort of fruit bomb style, and he became so powerful that by the 90s, winemakers all over the world were making wine in that style, hoping that he would give them a higher score.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah. So as a result of, as you said, the huge influence that he had, not just in the US market, but actually globally as well, that really drove the momentum to that kind of style of wine. And then the sort of third point that Dwight highlights is that during the late 80s, and actually impact more in the 90s, is phylloxera in Napa. So many wineries were having to replant due to diseased vines.
Phylloxera is a devastating disease that wiped out many of Europe's vineyards in the 19th century. And I didn't realise it had reached Napa in the 1980s.
Yeah, it did. So they had to replant, so new rootstock and new clones. And the ones that they were using had comparatively, or would produce comparatively, higher levels of sugar, which ergo into, you know, turns out, or the, what ends up, the wine we end up with therefore has higher alcohol levels. They also moved to a new trellising system. So trellising being the way the vines are pruned and then guided on the fruiting wires. And that impacts the amount of sunlight that the leaves get in turn. That then goes into photosynthesis, and that then determines how much sugar you end up in the grapes. So in this case, the leaves on the vines got more sunlight on these clones, more sugar, higher alcohol levels. And then thirdly, or on this kind of technology side, that there was the use of more modern yeasts, which were better at converting sugar in the grapes into alcohol. So we've got all of these different things. We've got consumer demand. We've got the influence of the critic Robert Parker. And then we've got these changes in viticulture and vinification, all of which led to this more alcoholic style of wine being produced in Napa.
Okay, so now we've talked about all of that. Do you think there's more or less variation in wine styles being produced globally in the last 30 years? So is it that there are changes in wine styles that have impacted your friend Kate, or has she changed in terms of her own preferences?
Okay, so if we take the first part of that, so if we look at the grape varieties that are being produced globally, actually, we're moving to more unified planting of grapes.
And is that right?
Yeah.
That is counterintuitive, because I was under the impression that there was more variation in terms of wine styles today compared with the past. So explain this.
Okay. So yes, there are more indigenous or local grapes being produced and sold at local levels, or certainly at more premium price points, and so therefore to a certain extent exported. But if we look at the mass market, so the majority of the volume, and that's the globally, if we take, let's take Cabernet Sauvignon and Merlot, so two red varietals. Back in the 1990s, in terms of the sort of total volume of wine produced or area planted, they ranked 8th and 7th in terms of being most frequently produced red grape types. Roll the clock forward to 2020, so 30 years on, and they're now ranking number one and number two. Yeah. And that's according to which wine grape varieties are grown where. And that's a global empirical study by Anderson and Nelgen. And that's this lovely, which I get very excited about, 793-page tome on...
That's good for a few cups of tea.
Yeah. Good to bedtime reading. But no, it's a great resource. And actually, it's open source, so anybody can find that resource and use it. So actually, we're seeing more homogenization globally in terms of wine styles. It's the same with Chardonnay. So again, you know, there's more Chardonnay being produced now than there was 30 years ago. So yes, we have this sort of long tail of alternate and different wine styles. So for wine connoisseurs and wine experts, people that are really into drinking wine, they are seeing a broader variety. But for the majority of consumers, we're actually moving towards this more homogenous style of wine. And partly that comes from the grape varieties, but it's also about flavour.
I've got a few things to say about that. So I was the editor of a couple of different wine magazines for 15 years. And when you're dealing with wine writers, they all like discovering new things. So they're always pitching what's new. And actually what this means is if you were to read the wine media, you would believe that wine is more heterogeneous than it actually is, because wine writers don't want to look at commercial styles of wine because they can't really build their reputation that way. So I think that distorts things. And I think there's something else going on, which is if you talk to people who analyze the market, they'll tell you something interesting as well. So I recently spoke to Katerina Axelson from Tastry, which is a chemistry company that uses AI to analyze wine. And she said it's very clear that the big brands have become more homogenous, which she puts down to the fact that they're spending a lot more time analyzing and benchmarking their competitors. So actually what's on the wine shelf is converging, as you're saying, it's not becoming more differentiated. And I think that's true in our food as well. I think that's, you know, we're eating less types of apples, less types of potatoes. It's interesting, maybe even a bit disturbing. All right, so let's sum up where we are now. So we've spoken about the homogenization of wine, but paradoxically, there's also more variety available than when I first started drinking, which is in the late 90s. So now we've got natural wine, we've got orange wine, we've got styles that were unthinkable 20 or 25 years ago. Is the wine world going to keep expanding, or is it going to contract? What do you think?
Well, if we look at the IWSR data, and IWSR track volume and value of wine and indeed all beverage alcohol categories, if we take a 10-year time horizon, so 2018 to 2028, The bad news for wine producers is that we're going to see around a 20% reduction in volume of wine consumed globally in that 10-year period. So that's one in five bottles less being consumed for listing.
It's huge.
Yeah. So that volume reduction on the amount of wine consumed globally is primarily at the lower price points, not the higher price points. So we're kind of losing that volume at the value end of the market. And marginally, we're seeing an increase in higher priced wines, although that, again, according to IWSR, that's kind of tending to come off a little bit now. And those premium price points are not in growth as they were, say, 5 years ago. And that therefore impacts the kind of styles you get in premium.
Can you define premium styles? Do you mean they taste better? They've got more flavour? What's a premium wine style?
Okay, no, sorry. There, again, talking about IWSR data, I'm referring to premium price points. So it's literally a kind of price brand. So that would be over $15 US, over $10 Euro, et cetera, okay, et cetera, depending on which market you're in.
Okay, but I think a lot of mediocre wines are probably going to disappear from the market because they couldn't differentiate themselves enough. So there aren't enough buyers for that type of wine or those vineyards.
Yeah, yeah, I think that's a really good point when you talk about kind of mediocre wines there. And I think one of the biggest differences, looking back to Kate and what she was asking us, who is a real person, is that in terms of wine style today, there are actually very few bad wines produced in the world. So most of the wine is actually made really well from a technical point of view. So now, whether you like them or not, and what your favorite style is, what your personal preference is, you know, it's not going to be so impacted by fault as very few wines are now sold that have technical winemaking faults.
That's really true. So I judged a wine competition in Europe for the first time in 2008. Now, if you train in wine in Australia, the first thing they teach you about is wine faults, all the things that can go wrong while you're making wine.
Doom and gloom then.
Yeah, no, well, they're really obsessive about that in Australia, for which now they get criticized for being too clean and technically correct. But anyway, so when I was learning about wine in the 90s, even before I learned to name all the varieties, you had to learn to recognize this is Brettanomyces, this is ethyl acetate, this is corked, or whatever. So I knew about all of that stuff, even though I didn't know as much about appellations as I should have. And I was sitting there at this competition for 4 or 5 days, tasting 45 wines a day, and so many of them were faulty. And yet most of the European judges I was sitting with couldn't identify it as a fault. They saw it as a wine style. And in the times that they did recognize there was something wrong, they'd just say it was corked. It was like there was this all-purpose term for, you know, there's something funny about this wine. And yet a decade later, not only was everybody spotting those faults immediately, but the faults were disappearing anyway. And now every couple of years, I judge the bulk wine competition. Now, bulk wine is the world's most commoditized wine. It's technically, it's about 70 cents a litre, to put it in context. And these days, it's technically fault-free. It's very palatable.
Yeah, absolutely. And I guess that's kind of a problem because it means if you're a wine producer, because you haven't got that level of competitive advantage about being good quality, because most wines are good quality or certainly fault free. So you sort of need something else to be going on as well.
Yeah, I always say when people criticize commercial wines, I always say, you know, today's commercial wines are better than what medieval monarchs were drinking. So what do you think the current key styles are now?
Okay, so we've talked actually quite a bit about rosé. And although if we remember, you know, again, according to OIV, that's just around 10% of global wine consumed. But we are seeing a shift, again, if we look at IWSR data, particularly towards premium rosé. So I always think about rosé as I kind of call it the universal donor of wine. So by that, I mean, very few people don't like the taste of rosé. So if we take let's take the US market as an example again, IWSR data shows us that 33%, so around a third of regular wine drinkers who are male in the US also drink rosé wine. So if we compare that to men, let's say the UK, that's around 37% of men, regular wine drinkers, male regular wine drinkers enjoy rosé. So what we're seeing here is that the kind of rosé is this kind of universal. It's not a gendered product anymore. Mm. And I think that's part of the growth, because if you're growing, you kind of have to appeal to everyone, not just half the population.
Yeah, I can see that for myself where I am. So I live in Germany, close to the French border. I sometimes go over the border to the French supermarkets because they're great. And you can see the banks and banks and banks of rosé in the supermarkets. France was always the big market for rosé back in even 2000, I think 80% of the wine sold in French supermarkets was, no, 80% was red, 10% was white and 10% was rosé.
But absolutely. Yeah, it has actually. So if you look at the picture today, red's dropped from 80% to 60%. White stayed about the same on 10%, but rosé's grown to 30% of wine sold in French supermarkets is now rosé. So we can see from that data that it's basically rosé is taking share from red, not white.
Yeah, now there's something else going on that we should mention. If you talk to online sellers and retailers, they'll tell you that they always used to stock red and white wines by season. In fact, they still do. But a couple of years ago, some of them in Germany bought a lot of red wines for winter, and then winter didn't come because it was so hot. Summer was extended for so long. And so people just kept drinking whites and rosés very late into the year. So because the seasons themselves are breaking down, some of these other categories are breaking down as well.
Yeah, absolutely. So other wine styles that we're seeing changing in popularity, we've talked about sparkling. Mm-hmm. So again, if we look at the IWSR forecast growth for still versus sparkling out to the next 4 years to 2028, we're seeing that from a volume point of view, as we said earlier, still wine is not growing. Actually, there is some growth still coming, according to IWSR forecasts, in the sparkling wine sector. And we've seen really strong growth in sparkling wine globally. And again, at a variety of price points around the world.
Do you know what's driving this? Was this the ubiquitousness of Prosecco that allowed people to have what had been a sort of celebratory drink but now have it all the time? What's been the driver of that?
Yeah. Well, it's partly that. So it's about accessibility of price point, again, to this broader target audience rather than a narrow niche of more affluent or wealthy consumers. So a bit like our rosé there. But again, if we think about Cava or Prosecco, so those types of sparkling wines at those price points, they're just, yes, more accessible from a price point, but they're kind of like these universal donor products we were talking about. So very few consumers don't like the taste of Cava or Prosecco, or indeed, you know, Australian-made sparkling wine. And again, our occasions are shifting for consuming alcohol. So we have more what are termed as kind of mini celebration occasions or mini event marketing moments. So sparkling wine is such a physical product with the pop and the fizz. So it's, and we've also got an underlying consumer trend, not just in alcohol, but in drinks overall, towards more carbonated drinks as a trend.
More carbonated drinks. Sorry, that's something we'll have to talk about at length at some point. But while we still have time, can you talk through another trend of the last 10, 15 years, which is orange natural low intervention? Where do you see that going? Are we all going to be drinking those styles of wine soon?
Yeah, so I think back to the point you were making earlier. You were talking about wine writers sort of looking for the new, the different, and getting broader than just Cabernet Sauvignon. And we see this a little bit with natural and orange. I do observe that often talking about those wines is a conversation between us in the wine industry as opposed to the majority of wine consumers. Now, that's not to say that clearly there aren't consumers. You know, you go to Denmark and see the natural wine bar boom going there, that there aren't consumers that like this.
Yeah, I think when people are asked about, you know, whether they like natural wine or not, I think a lot of people think of wine as being a natural product. So maybe rather than thinking of the category that we would call natural wine, they're thinking of natural versus something artificial. You know, maybe that changes things as well.
Yeah,
Are you a big drinker of natural wines?
No, big confession. Okay, so that's not my personal taste. I don't typically like the style of natural wines. So this is not a disclaimer, not a professional commentary on natural wines. It is the style I like. I don't like that style of wine so much. But let me just pick up on a point you made there. From a consumer point of view, we can see again in IWSR data that there has been an increase in many markets around the world of consumers stating that they are more interested in natural styles of wine. Now, but actually, if you delve in and you start to interview and you do your ethnography, we were talking about that earlier. What you find actually is to your point, which is consumers are really thinking about wine overall as being a natural product. You know, when you talk to consumers in so many countries, they have this vision of wine is simply grapes grown on a vine, that a man comes along, because it's always a man in a red tractor, because it's always a red tractor in their minds. They pull off the grapes, they squish them, they put them in a barrel, and then a few months later, they turn a tap. And that's a positive association with wine, but also confusing on this natural versus low intervention.
Yeah, interesting. While I remember, while we're talking about natural wine, I should also add that sometimes political decisions can drive wine trends as well.
Yeah.
So in 2006, the country of Georgia got kicked out of the Russian market as retaliation for their political aspirations to join Europe. Now, Georgia has been making wine for thousands upon thousands of years, 8,000 years continuously, and their wines were very, very popular within the Russian market. So they lost their major market, and so they had to scramble to find other markets, and they had to reorient themselves towards the West. So the U.S. actually came in with money to help them do that and help them export. So the Georgians actually introduced Fevrie wines and these very ancient traditions to the West. Now, it's not that everybody drinks orange wines, but they fascinated the wine community outside Georgia, and it helped to kickstart this incredible natural wine boom. And even though people like ordinary consumers might not be drinking natural wines, the fact that natural wines were now a thing and being talked about in the wine community actually got conventional winemakers to start thinking a bit more about how they could make their wine with less sort of processing aids and additives and be a bit more daring about the winemaking. And so I think Mr. Putin's decision, or I should say it was something like the sanitation inspector in Moscow, whoever it was, that one decision has actually had a profound impact on the world of wine.
Yeah, absolutely. And the low intervention style is definitely something that you see. I'm thinking of when I was recently in New York, I was just talking about being in Denmark, you know, that kind of, but it is still quite niche.
Yeah. Okay. So we've talked a bit about how styles come in and out of the market and how some styles come in and others drop out. But when you get these technological changes or you get new varieties or, you know, whatever, how does it enter the market? My gut instinct would be that there's a buyer somewhere looking for something that suits their budget that they can put on shelves. So wine is very driven by currency exchange rates. And certainly if you're a buyer for a big supermarket chain in England, if, you know, the euro suddenly gets expensive, then you might start looking somewhere like Georgia, because it's cheaper. But the funny thing about that is, and also many of these wine buyers are wine lovers themselves, and they often try and put things on the shelf that they think are, you know, that they love and they think more attention. But many of them have said that they try to push wines and then the public rejects them. So what does the research say about how wine actually gets to market?
Yeah, that's really interesting. It reminds me of many years ago, so aging myself, when I was working for the Thresher Group, Victoria Wine, here in the UK, which was at the time we had over 2,000 stores, off-license stores, selling wine and booze. Yeah, those were the days, eh? This is pre the sort of heady height of supermarket boom for wine sales in the UK. And I remember one of the wine buyers I was working with getting so excited about listing a white Rioja. So this is back in the mid-1990s. And, you know, because he, as a technical expert, really was excited about the wine style. But can you imagine in the 1990s in an off-license chain, you know, going through all of the UK, how many people would understand what a white Rioja was? So I think that's a really good point. But you called me a data maven before.
I know, which
I think I'm going to adopt that as my new reference. And so I'm going to try and live up to my reputation. So yes, I've got data. So a good example of this would of a retail demand, so it's push and pull that we're talking about here in supply chain management, would be the category style of low and no alcohol wine. So obviously this is building on the general consumer trend for wellness and health, based on coming out in terms of moderation. So both producers and retailers are really looking at this driving. But interestingly, what we're not seeing is that demand coming so much from a consumer point of view. So that pull off the shelves for low and no wine specifically. So clearly there's a strong demand for lower alcohol or no alcohol drinks. We know that. But is it for that specific style? So will Kate be drinking, for example, more low and no alcohol wine specifically? Let's contextualize this with data that the no and low alcohol wine globally, again, according to IWSR, is still less than 2% of the overall wine sales globally.
Yeah, I've got a lot of thoughts about this as you're speaking. So first of all, technology, going back to technology, often drives changes. The technology that removes alcohol from wine is still, the end result is still not as palatable as you would like it to be. In the beer people have solved that. They can make very, very good non-alcoholic
beers.
But it's very difficult to do that in wine. So there might actually be pent-up demand. It's just what's being supplied isn't meeting that demand, maybe.
Yeah, good
but
point.
But going back to your thing about the white Rioja in supermarkets. So what we haven't answered is then, well, how do new trends arise if somebody wants to push it, how does it get into the market? And the answer is actually in the entree in restaurants. So if you can get sommeliers who can stand at the table and say, you should really try this white Rioja, that's how it gets into the market. And then once there's some demand that way, that's when it starts to show up in supermarkets. But anyway, so let's summarize let's go down another road. So your friend Kate, wine styles have definitely changed, and we've talked a lot about that and all the reasons that they can change, from technology to taxation to somebody invading another country. But it's also possible that your friend's taste has changed as well. So there's quite a lot of scientific evidence about this, which was summarised in a Discover article last year about the way our taste changes over time. And unfortunately, one of the drivers of this is that our taste buds simply become less sensitive. So as we get older, we can take more tannin, we can take more chili, we can take all sorts of things that were, you know, very difficult for us to swallow when we were younger. So one of the consequences of that is that a lot of people who grew up on Parker style wines now simply can't drink them. They're just too much. It's too much tannin, too much alcohol. And it's not just because the zeitgeist has changed, it's because they themselves have changed.
Okay, so that's quite bad news, Felicity. I was thinking that I was becoming more sophisticated as I was maturing.
You are, Lulu. You absolutely are becoming more sophisticated. And it's not because your palate is aging.
Okay, go ahead. I've commented several times on your age, so let's go carry on.
All right, so on aging and taste buds.
Yeah.
Okay, so there's actually two pathways to taste. One is, you know, what your taste buds are telling you, but one is based on your knowledge and memory. So somebody who's an older wine critic whose taste buds might be less sensitive than when they're 18 is still going to be a better taster in a competition against an 18-year-old because they have an incredible memory and a knowledge bank that somebody else doesn't have. So it's not just the physical equipment that you've got, but also what knowledge you bring to it, but it's also absolutely true that the physical equipment changes over time.
Yeah. So there's a lot of changes with our physical equipment as we age, but I think that's for a different kind of podcast.
Yeah, let's talk about that one night over a very long drink. Okay, so let's try and sum all of this up. What are the takeaways from all of this? Why do wine styles suddenly become popular or unpopular?
Well, if we think back to review what we've talked about, there's definitely consumer and therefore market demand. We also need to layer in cultural trends. So you talked earlier about Instagrammable and millennial pink to do with rosé. We talked about sharing moments for casualization and celebration. So occasions are changing and that can impact styles of wine as well. We haven't really touched on it. You just mentioned it very briefly then. There's also the legal and tax implications. So, for example, here in the UK, we literally are just about to enter into a time where the tax rate on wine, which is pretty high relatively in the UK, is now going to vary by alcohol level. So the higher the alcohol in the wine, the more tax. The lower the alcohol in the wine, the less tax.
Yes, I have to say that is the most extraordinary decision to be made. So as I understand it, the tax changes at every, 0.5% of alcohol? So there's like 30 different tax regimes about to be applied to wine. It's quite extraordinary.
It's quite some system. And as I'm sure you can imagine, all of those supplying into the UK, you know, it is just adding layers of complexity, which inevitably come with layers of cost, which inevitably come with reduced margins.
Yeah, so it's you know, just going to disappear from the shelves, to be honest.
Yeah.
Okay, so but we've also got other drivers of change, of technological changes. So we've talked about how very little wine anymore is bad or has faults. And we've absolutely got climate change impacting everything. It's impacting us, it's impacting the vineyard, it's impacting the grapes. So what we come down to is basically anything and everything can change the trajectory of wine. So what do you think is going to come next?
Well, I think we're still going to see the shift towards rosé and white. I don't see that disappearing anytime soon.
Yeah, probably at the expense of red wine. An ongoing problem.
Yeah, correct. Yeah, correct. And particularly lighter styles of red. So by lighter, I don't mean not full flavoured, but I'm referring more to a reduction in the kind of tannic quality. So the more fruit forward flavour wines, there'll always clearly be a place for big reds. You know, I'm not saying that we won't have them, but they're just not so majority and mainstream. I think we will also continue to see growth in sparkling, as I referred to earlier. IWSR are forecasting growth in sparkling. And I think we'll also, interestingly, in sparkling, see markets turning more towards local production of sparkling. So by that, I mean more Americans, for example, drinking American-produced sparkling, Brazilians drinking Brazilian-produced sparkling, which, by the way, they drink quite a lot of it anyway. And one thing that we haven't touched on is I also think we'll see more alternative formats and sizes, particularly for wine. So there was a great quote I read from Simon Mason, who's the head of sustainability at the Wine Society, which is an online retailer here in the UK. And he said, in an era where people will drink less alcohol, 50cl will become the standard bottle.
Yeah, and cans as well. And I think that's something we haven't touched on is social changes, that people are spending more time not just moderating, but they're spending more time alone or they're spending more time doing something by themselves and they want, they want a single serve.
Yeah.
But cans, yes, we should talk about that at some point.
Yeah. And that's a really good subject, cans. So I think I'm thinking that cans is a whole episode in and of itself because there's so much to talk about.
Oh, really?
From a production point of view, from a supply chain point of view, from a consumer point of view. So can we do an episode? Maybe one of my imaginary friends will ask us a question about cans, Felicity.
Yes, Lily, we can do an episode on cans. But I think we've now come to the end of this episode.
Yeah, we have. Thank you, Felicity. So until next time, this has been A Question of Drinks. You've been listening to A Question of Drinks, the podcast that explores why we drink what we do.
And we're here to answer your questions. If you want to know more about anything drinks, from the marketing history to the economic underpinnings to why this drink is popular and not that one, send us an email.
Send any questions you'd like to discuss, and quite frankly, the more random and niche the better, and we'll have a go at answering them. We can be reached on aquestionofdrinks@gmail.com. That's aquestionofdrinks, all one word, @gmail.com.
And we would hugely appreciate you rating this podcast before you go. 5 stars are much appreciated.